These voices made headlines this week.
The best thing that can happen for the country is for the Congress to go home.
It is time to give the streets back to the law-abiding citizens and to put the criminals behind bars.
I think it's a question of preventive medicine. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Voices in the headlines, the sounds of the news this week gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC News. I'm George Caldwell, ABC News, New York.
A president who vetoes jobs, a president who vetoes assistance for middle-income families who want to send their children to college, who vetoes funds for medical and health research. Funds for libraries, schools throughout the United States, for child nutrition, for vocational rehabilitation of handicapped persons. I think those vetoes are bad for the American people.
Democratic Congressman John Brademas of Indiana, the House Majority Whip, assessing the 94th Congress as it headed for adjournment on Friday. Fresh in his mind was Congress's latest veto battle with President Ford. It was a $56 billion appropriations bill for social services, education, employment, health, and welfare, and it became Mr. Ford's 59th veto on Wednesday. A day later, the House and the Senate overrode the President's veto, only the 12th time that Congress had been able to do so. Senate Republican Whip Robert Griffin of Michigan defended Mr. Ford's veto policy.
The fact that most of President Ford's vetoes were sustained in the Congress, I think, is very interesting, because at the beginning of this Congress, it was referred to as a veto-proof Congress. Not only have Republicans generally stuck with the president, but a number of Democrats have recognized the wisdom of his vetoes in trying to hold down federal spending.
Despite the veto confrontations, Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, now the acting Democratic leader in the Senate, assesses the 94th Congress as one of achievement.
It has extended the Voting Rights Act for 7 years. It has passed the first antitrust legislation that has been enacted in a generation. It redesigned a $22.8 billion tax cut to halt the worst depression since the 1930s, and it refocused that tax cut to benefit the middle-income and the low-income people.
Byrd says it was not a do-nothing Congress, but House Republican Leader John Rhodes of Arizona disagrees.
It's been unproductive. It's done things backwards. For instance, we started out trying to get more energy, and we passed a bill that produced less energy. We still have deficits. We still have a legislative program which will result in more inflation instead of less. This has not been a good Congress for this country.
Senator Griffin went one step further.
The best thing that can happen for the country is for the Congress to go home.
With the end of the 94th Congress, many legislators were prepared to head home and campaign for re-election. Some others, though, were prepared to make way for new faces. Most notably among those retiring from Congress were three key leaders: Senate Democratic Leader Mike Mansfield of Montana, Senate Republican Leader Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, and House Speaker Carl Albert of Oklahoma. The 1976 presidential campaign wrapped up its first official month with one pollster predicting no predictions. That is, the race between President Ford and Jimmy Carter may become too close to call. Carter campaigned hard this week with appearances from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine, while the president wrapped up a southern swing before returning to Washington. In Miami on Monday, Mr. Ford delivered a tough speech on crime to a convention of the national police chiefs.
We cannot count in dollars. We cannot count in cents the loss of a single citizen who is murdered, the humiliation of one who is raped, the pain of one who is assaulted. We cannot calculate the cost to a free society when people are forced to barricade themselves in their own homes. It is time to give the streets back to the law-abiding citizens and to put the criminals behind bars.
The president called for strong measures against juvenile offenders.
45% of all violent crime is now perpetrated by juveniles. If they are big enough to commit vicious crimes against society, they are big enough to be punished by society.
President Ford promised, if elected, he'll begin a crusade on crime within the first 100 days of his new administration. Jimmy Carter also had something to say about crime Monday in Portland, Oregon.
Poverty is not an excuse for crime, but it's a reason for, a cause of, crime. So what this Republican administration has done to our country is not only devastating in economic terms, but it's devastating in human terms.
Carter saying much crime is caused by unemployment when poor families send their children out to find jobs. They can't, and instead turn to such things as shoplifting or dope pushing. The White House acknowledged Tuesday that President Ford had played golf as the guest of several major corporations when he was a member of Congress. Such outings were previously disclosed by William White, a lobbyist for U.S. Steel and a close friend of Mr. Ford's. In Evansville, Indiana, Monday night, Jimmy Carter took up the subject without mentioning the president by name.
Public officials, lobbyists, special interest groups go to the same private clubs. They go to the same restaurants. They play golf on the same golf courses. They learn about unemployment, inflation, housing problems from staff reports, of bureaucrats. They avoid direct contact with people. They don't go in people's homes.
Another report plaguing the president was that the Special Prosecutor's Office has been investigating campaign contributions to Republican campaign committees in Mr. Ford's home district in Michigan. In Plains, Georgia, Jimmy Carter contended,
"The easiest way to resolve it is for Mr. Ford to face the news media for a change, answer tough cross-examination questions, and let the American people know the facts."
The next day, President Ford told reporters to bring pad and pencil to the White House, as we heard from ABC correspondent Charles Gibson.
The reporters were called into the Oval Office so that Mr. Ford could answer questions on the reported investigations into his past. It was what Jimmy Carter said Mr. Ford ought to do, but the president denied he called the news conference because of Carter's remarks. The president expressed full confidence in the special prosecutor, but said when the investigation into his past congressional campaigns is complete, he is sure he will be free of any of the charges he has read about. As for golfing weekends Mr. Ford took when he was in the Congress, the president said there was substantial reciprocity, that he gave as much as he got to those who had entertained him. Our getting together has been in a proper way, he said, and if legislation was discussed, it was just in passing. Charles Gibson, ABC News, the White House.
ABC correspondent Sam Donaldson asked Jimmy Carter in Boston if he was satisfied with the president's statement.
Yes, I accept the statement.
Do you think that should end the matter?
I don't have any way to know. As far as I'm concerned, it does.
In another possible problem for the Ford campaign, the White House on Friday announced that Agriculture Secretary Earl Butz had received a severe reprimand from President Ford about a statement Butz made last summer, which is just now reaching the public. In that remark, Butz described the sex and other personal habits of black people in just about the crudest language possible. The Butz remark triggered this reaction from the only black member of the Senate, Republican Edward Brook of Massachusetts.
I read the statement of Secretary Earl Butz, and I find it vulgar and offensive. And I called upon the president to ask for Secretary Butz's resignation. I believe that no man is fit to serve in the cabinet of the President of the United States who harbors such thoughts.
Brooke was joined in calling for Butz's removal by a number of other Republicans, including Jacob Javits of New York and Charles Mathias of Maryland. There was some economic news Tuesday which could have an effect on the November election. The government reported its index of leading economic indicators dropped 1.5%, the first decline in 18 months. Our economics editor, Dan Kortz, took a look.
It takes more than 1 month's decline in the index of leading indicators to establish a trend, but even some administration economists admit they're unhappy about today's figures. They clearly confirm that the economy has turned sluggish, and they could signal something much worse, such as a downturn in overall economic activity this winter. From the administration's point of view, the most worrisome fact is this. The next index of leading indicators will come out just a few days before the election. And if that index is down too, it'll be a political bombshell. Dan Kortz, ABC News, Washington.
Wall Street didn't wait, though. After starting the week well over 1,000, the market dipped more than 18 points the day of the government announcement. The competition didn't wait either. Senator Walter Mondale, the Democratic vice presidential nominee, told the United Mine Workers National Convention in Cincinnati what he thought of the U.S. economy.
It's not getting better. It's getting worse. And they say, well, we've loused it up. All we want is four more years. Well, we listened to that four more years junk 4 years ago. We're not going to listen to it this time. We're going to put a people's president there who'll put people back to work, who's got the guts to fight inflation, and who will do the things that people need to have a decent life in this country again. That's what that campaign is all about.
While the U.S. economy was in the doldrums, the British pound was also taking a beating. The pound, once the world's strongest currency, dropped to just under $1.64, its lowest point ever. Just last year, the pound was worth $2.40. British Prime Minister James Callaghan took note of his country's economic problems in a speech to his Labour Party in Blackpool, England.
The cozy world, which we were told would go on forever, where full employment would be guaranteed by a stroke of the Chancellor's pen, cutting taxes, deficit spending, that cozy world is gone.
Callaghan said Britain can no longer spend its way out of recession. For some Americans, news of the drop in the British pound is not all that bad. That's because fewer dollars buy more pounds. We asked Peter French Hodges of the British Tourist Authority what effect the pound's rate has been having on the number of American tourists.
It has had a big effect, but we hope that people come for other reasons as well. But since Europe is quite expensive for America, obviously the fact that more people have been coming here than last year and the year before is to a large extent due to the economic realities.
About 1 million Americans visit England each year. The question of black majority rule in Southern Africa moved to the forefront in the United Nations General Assembly this week. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger delivered a major speech on the subject, but not before Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko made a caustic reference to the Kissinger plan for the African region. Through an interpreter, Gromyko told the 31st General Assembly on Tuesday,
"Every possible method is being resorted to, from direct suppression and violence to attempts to divert the national liberation movement from genuine independence and freedom, through political gimmickry and financial handouts."
2 days later, Kissinger had a response.
"There may be some countries who see a chance for advantage in fueling the flames of war and racial hatred. But they are not motivated by concern for the peoples of Africa or for peace. And if they succeed, they could doom opportunities that might never return."
Kissinger went on to tell the General Assembly,
"We will back no faction, whether in Rhodesia or elsewhere. We will not seek to impose solutions anywhere. The leadership and the future of an independent Zimbabwe, as for the rest of Africa, are for Africans to decide. The United States will abide by their decision. We call on all other non-African states to do likewise."
The State Department described the Kissinger plan for Southern Africa this week as shaky, but on track. And on Friday, Rhodesian forces battled black nationalist guerrillas along the border with Mozambique. It was described as one of the heaviest engagements of their war. Despite that fact, British Ambassador Ivor Richards said he would soon prepare to chair a conference called to set up an interim government in Rhodesia. Lebanese Christians, backed by the Syrian army, began a major attack this week to drive Palestinians from a wide section of the mountains east of Beirut. One town retaken by the Christian and Syrian forces was Mutain, Lebanon, and ABC correspondent Jerry King was there.
Standing in a cemetery beside a church, a Christian church in the town of Mutain, which for 6 months was in the hands of the Palestinians and Lebanon, and after a major operation, part of the Syrian assault, on Tuesday, this town again reverted to Christian and Syrian hands. And the church bells been rung in joyous celebration of the return of the Christians to this particular town.
After 3 days of fighting, one Palestinian spokesman indicated a Christian victory was just a matter of time. There was another development concerning a Middle East country this week, and it happened in the halls of Congress. First, there was a report by the Middle East News Agency that Foreign Minister Faisal of Saudi Arabia had threatened an oil embargo against the U.S. if Congress passed legislation aimed at the Arab boycott of Israel. Assistant Treasury Secretary Gerald Parsky moved to correct the report.
"The Saudi Arabian officials, the foreign minister and others, have indicated to me that there has been no threat retaliatory action. Apparently there has been some misinformation in the newspapers with respect to what they have said.
Despite Parsky's statement, the Ford administration began lobbying to keep Congress from blocking a sale of missiles to Saudi Arabia. The missile sale had become intertwined with a move to keep American companies from going along with the Arab trade boycott against Israel. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee had already voted to block the sale, but after Secretary Kissinger warned the move could undermine U.S. Middle East policy, the committee reversed itself. Committee member Clifford Case, a New Jersey Republican, was unhappy.
Unless we get hold of our foreign arms sales and our arms program generally, we're going to have such a ballooning that only catastrophe can result.
Case wanted to block the sale, which would send 650 air-to-ground Maverick missiles to Saudi Arabia at a cost of $30 million. Two congressional committees heard testimony this week on the problems of narcotics and alcohol. Members of the House Select Committee on Narcotics complained that the administration and the CIA were not doing enough to stop the flow of illegal narcotics into the U.S. But CIA Director George Bush testified.
Our problem is we are restricting ourselves to the kinds of national foreign intelligence on that maybe isn't as helpful to the enforcement guy who wants to make a bust, that knows a car bringing some fella across the border is going to come in.
And Bush said the CIA must be careful to avoid what some people have called its excesses of the past. As the committee continued its hearings, the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Dr. Robert DuPont, was called to testify. Committee member Robin Beard, a Tennessee Republican, told DuPont more must be done to deal with traffickers.
Do you not think it would help if we studied the judicial aspect of it to some way or the other, that when we catch these bums, we throw them underneath the jail to where they never walk out again? Would this not make your job somewhat easier, and would you not think it's justified? I'm talking about the suppliers.
Beard listened as DuPont had a suggestion.
There are about $7 billion of profits going to these traffickers in the United States today. They are not paying taxes on them, and they should be in jail. So if there is one technique that is not being used on this side that should be, it's the Internal Revenue Service Code.
But committee member Charles Rangel, Democrat from New York, said the real answer is to provide jobs for rehabilitated addicts.
My most successful rehabilitated addict, which is used for statistical data, which is shown to all of the visiting congressional committees, is the guy that went through the program and was hired by the program. I don't have anybody to show that was hired by IBM, ITT, the federal government, city or local government. I don't have that.
DuPont agreed with Rangel that jobs for rehabilitated addicts would cut the rate of heroin use, but pointed out it wouldn't eliminate the problem. Over in the Senate, the Labor Welfare Subcommittee on Alcoholism held hearings on the woman alcoholic. Chairman William Hathaway, Democrat of Maine, opened the hearings by saying,
alcohol and tranquilizers have become the most frequently abused drug combination in the United States, and it is women who account for a majority of such usage. Women today account for 59% of all physician visits and 68% of all the prescriptions of psychotropic drugs.
And Hathaway said the problem is also serious among young girls.
One Northern California survey of high school students found out that the number of boys using alcohol over 50 times a year has doubled since 1970, but that the number of girls who drink heavily by the same criteria has tripled.
One of those testifying before Hathaway's committee was Dr. Susan B. Anthony, grandniece of the well-known feminist and now a member of the National Council on Alcoholism. Dr. Anthony said she had not touched a drink in 30 years.
My goal as I celebrate my 30th anniversary as a recovered woman alcoholic is to use the time that is left to help make our society one in which sobriety is not only possible, but is also desirable. A society in which it is no longer necessary to get smashed to get happy.
The mayor of Indianapolis, Indiana, kicked off the biggest immunization program in the history of the United States Friday. Reporters were on hand as Mayor William Hudnett received the first swine flu shot from Dr. James Bowes.
I look when they're giving me a shot, so I will look the other way.
Okay, fine. Okay, here we go. That's it, good. Okay.
Dubnut was followed by several thousand people who were vaccinated for the swine flu at the city's annual health fair. Hudnut explained his feelings for the program.
I think it's a question of preventive medicine. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And they say that if we don't do this, it is possible that we might have as much as 50,000 deaths in the country as a result of a flu pandemic, and at a cost of some $6 billion. Those are the figures I've seen, so I think it's worthwhile.
In Washington, ABC science editor Jules Bergman talked with Dr. Theodore Cooper of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare about the swine flu.
Do you see any signs of a swine flu epidemic so far?
No, I do not. We have surveillance stations set up across the nation. We are looking for it for all flu as well as swine flu. But as yet, we are not seeing very much flu at all, and no swine flu as yet.
Cooper said every adult who wants a shot for the swine flu will be able to get it by Christmas. As the week ended, there was a report of an apparent flu epidemic on the U.S.-ruled island of Guam. Absenteeism in public schools on Guam had reached 100%, with 75% absenteeism in most private businesses, and nearly 30% of the Guam police force had called in sick. All this was happening as the first shipment of vaccine for the swine flu reached the island. Authorities were fairly certain, however, that the illness on Guam was not the swine flu. Names in the news this week included Muhammad Ali and Barbara Walters. Ali won a unanimous decision after a 15-round title fight with challenger Ken Norton. Ali kept his heavyweight title, but later in the week announced he was quitting the ring.
At the age of 34, I'm retired. I have homes, I have farms, I have millions and millions of dollars in government bonds. Now I want to take my time and teach them people and teach them my own children, my own son, and helping them to grow to be better than I am.
Ali talked with ABC News from Istanbul, Turkey, where he was the guest of the Muslim wing of the ruling coalition government. Ali said he will devote his energies to the Muslim faith. Muhammad Ali has talked about retirement before. Some think this time it's the real thing. While Ali is retiring, Barbara Walters is about to do something no woman has done before, and for more money. She'll co-anchor an evening network news program on ABC beginning Monday. At a news conference in New York City Thursday, Barbara Walters admitted she was nervous.
What scares me to death is I watch and I hear everybody at one point or another making a mistake or clearing his throat. And I know that in my first two sentences on Monday, I will flub and everyone will say, you see, she can't read, you know, you see.
Barbara Walters talked about her $1 million a year salary.
There are people in the news business who, when you add the culmination of all of the different things that they do, their figure would come out to be relatively near this. And I finally hope that as of Monday when I start to work, I can be judged on what I do and not on what I'm paid.
So went This World This Week and the voices in the headlines. Voices in the headlines, the sounds of the news this week gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC News. Written and produced by Ed Bailey. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Directed by Barbara Silver. Engineering by Bob Ireland, Clark Ranger, and Michael Kay. Special effects by Ed Blaney. I'm George Caldwell, ABC News, New York. Voices in the Headlines is a production of ABC News.